8:11 now, good morning. Well, the Summit County Council meets tomorrow at the Sheldon Richens Building. That starts at about 3:30. And on the phone, I should say, as a rundown of the agenda is County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So at about 3:40, a presentation will be made on the redesigned county website. Better or just different?
I think it is better. We've spent about the last 6 months to a year with an internal team looking at the website, looking with our provider, Civic Plus, at what things they have to offer to make it act better, make it a little easier for folks to navigate. Of course, that's always a personal judgment, but we think we've made some improvements and even offered some space to some local artists in order to display some of their pictures along the way.
So did you just kind of pull people off the street, though, to ask them to navigate on the website? Because that's always a
good
clue.
We had both some folks from outside our organization and internal take a look at that and give us some advice on how to make that better.
Okay. Any idea what that cost us?
It's all built into the service that we get with Civic Plus. They've been the host for our website for several years, and it was just the natural progression of our contract to make those improvements.
Okay, well, it looks cleaner. I'll have to go spend some time on it and see what I think.
Yeah, any feedback you can provide us would be great.
Okay. At 4 o'clock, a discussion regarding the Summit County Public Lands Initiative. This is being led by Assistant County Manager Jana Young. The staff apparently presenting three options and recommending one. The first option is to do nothing. I guess, why not do this and just wait for the outcome of the 2020 presidential election?
Well, I mean, that's always an option. We're always looking at and having conversations with our congressional delegation to see what we should possibly be working on together. So a lot of different things go into deciding what we're going to do and whether we go forward with something. And some of that is internal workload, other strategic initiatives that we're looking at. But really, the likelihood of getting something passed and taking the advice of our federal delegation is probably the strongest one.
Well, the second option is to pursue a public lands initiative for the county alone. What have you heard talking with other stakeholders, our congressional representatives, including Mitt Romney and Ben McAdams, as well as Emory County, which did its own PLI?
Well, I mean, we did talk to Emory County, and their effort took several years in order to go alone, and took quite a bit of staff time to do that. So we're taking that into consideration. We've talked to Senator Romney's office, and they're very supportive of doing something, but they're giving us advice on timing. And then, of course, with Congressman Bishop likely retiring this year, that changes the landscape for us locally as well. Since he's our representative. So we have to take all of that into consideration, and I think that's what the council will be doing and providing advice back to staff on how to move forward.
All right, and the third option, which staff is recommending, is to pursue funding to prevent wildfires and to preserve watershed in forests. So why are we going this route, or at least recommending?
Well, I mean, I think in talking to all of those different folks that we would talk to get advice, looking at some of the initiatives that have come forth through the last Congress and through the administration, certainly wildfire management is a big national focus right now due to some of the issues that in the West from last year, especially in California. So there might be some opportunities to take advantage of there, as well as there's opportunities that our local forest managers want to pursue in concert with the county. And those might be the low-hanging fruit to accomplish some of our goals that would be looked at under the PLI while we reconsider that whole initiative.
Okay. And in terms of pursuing funding, what are we talking about?
Well, I mean, it's all different forms. There's a lot of federal funding available right now. to supplement some of the projects that the U.S. Forest Service managers in our area would want to accomplish. We can help them with that through our initiatives or our help through the congressional delegation. We can also be helping on the state level to make sure that not only are we able to do what we want to do, but that state law does not prevent us from working on something, or can we harness any of the energy or resources of our water districts to help protect watersheds through fire mitigation. So those are the things that we're looking at.
Okay. At about 4:20, the council convenes as basically the governing board of the Mountain Regional Water Special Service District. This is just to take a look at some of the past due fees and charges for the Special Service District. In terms of any updates from the Water District, I mean, are we doing okay, you know, with the kind of cooler, wetter spring? Guess we're not seeing a ton more outdoor watering as we have in the years past.
You know, I haven't had that specific conversation with the Water District, but it's a great question. You know, I think it's probably appropriate that we get the Water District in to talk about those kind of things. I think this item specifically will be about those past due fees and charges. But, you know, we have a regular meeting, our council leadership and the Water District board leadership, about two or three times a year, and that meeting is coming up for our chair and vice chair. So we'll probably be asking some of those questions, and if there's something that needs to be publicly brought forward, we'll do that on the agenda.
Okay. And what the council is taking action on Wednesday is basically certifying liens, and this is for against people who have not paid their water bills.
Yeah, that's essentially it. It's those that are behind on paying for their water, and this is just part of the process per state law in order for those liens to be put on their property.
Okay, so that's what you're leaning is their real estate, huh?
That's correct.
Any idea how much we're talking about?
I didn't get into the specifics in the packet on that. I'd have to look at that.
All right. Let's see. At 5 o'clock, the council may continue discussion on the entry gate at Trails at Jeremy Ranch and maybe make a decision. So what's the holdup on deciding one way or the other?
Well, I mean, the council held over the issue at their last meeting. They had some questions specific to the appellant and to our attorney's office representing me in my determination on the gate. They wanted a little bit more information. That has all been gathered together, as well as short briefs from each of the sides on this. Those are all in the packet and to be reviewed by the council. And so there'll be a further discussion amongst the council about this issue. I don't know if they'll take any more testimony from each of the sides or if they'll just talk about it from here forward.
All right. Now, your recommendation is that the gate come down, right?
That's correct. That was my determination based on what I saw at that time.
Okay. And we had council members at the last hearing, Roger Armstrong and Doug Clyde, who seemed to agree with you. Chris Robinson seemed to support it. Councilmember Kim Carson had asked for more information on a couple of items. One was in the 1994 code, is an entry gate a use and is it allowed? So do we have that answer?
Well, I think each side on this issue will have a different viewpoint of that. But, you know, the council in their role as the appellant body gets to make that determination, and we'll see if the information that's provided helps them get to that conclusion or not.
Kim Carson also wanted to know if a precedent had been set by the entry gate there at Moose Hollow.
That's correct, and I believe the information that she requested has been put into the record about Moose Hollow, so that they can make a further determination on that.
Okay, so have the attorneys agreed whether a precedent has been set?
No, I mean I think as part of the process, they've each opined on that based on what they've seen of that record. But I don't know if they've agreed or not. I would imagine there's still difference on that.
So the appeal record now over 1,000 pages. Will the attorneys on both sides be allowed to make their arguments again, or?
Well, they were asked to make arguments in a short brief. I think they were given 7 pages or less to make their final arguments. I don't know if there'll be any more oral testimony from each side or what. That's a determination of the counsel.
Okay. And again, I guess, why do we even care? I mean, who, unless you drive up there and access the property, what do we care if there's a gate or not?
Well, I think there's been issues in the past around access. Certainly there's emergency access concerns about gates. Our code since that time does not allow gates. Except on in certain situations, but you know, I think those are the things that get raised. And the other part of it is that if it was not contemplated at the time and it was then put in, there's an issue with that in regards to what was agreed to be built. So all of those issues surround this.
Yeah, so it's very procedural in that matter, in terms of just following the rules, huh?
That it is procedural. That's correct.
Okay, let's see. The final item, the joint session with the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission. Anything in particular that the council wants to accomplish in this meeting?
Yeah, so I believe what both the Planning Commission and the council will want to talk about is, you know, they've just the council just approved the Kimball Junction neighborhood plan as an update to the general plan, and there's some zoning considerations around the neighborhood mixed use zone versus a community commercial zone that they need to talk about. The Planning Commission has been working on some of those implementation tools around neighborhood mixed use zones and master planned development processes that they need to talk about. Certainly, site coverage and accessory building size has been an issue in the Snyderville Basin, and the Planning Commission has been working on that, and they'd like to bring forth what they're thinking about so that they can get some feedback from the council. And then they've also been working, the Planning Commission's also been working on incorporating some sustainability type initiatives within the code, and they wanted to get some feedback from the council on that as well.
Okay, Tom, anything else you wanted to mention?
Just three things. We've got three positions or several positions open on boards right now: the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission, the Board of Health, and still the Timberline Special Services District has an opening. So we're out actively recruiting.
Okay. Hey, Tom, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. It's 8:24. The Park City Planning Commission scheduled to spend its work session discussing the city's annexation policy plan. In the studio with details, I have Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Leslie.
So the Park City Council has discussed the annexation policy already. So why it seems like we're doing this backwards, or no?
Not really. And I agree with you. We shouldn't get too wonky on this. But basically, the council wanted an update on annexation policy, and they discussed it in April. And they asked us to bring back some recommendations. There's some other communities around that have put forth their annexation policies, and the council wants to make sure that our response is measured and adequate for that potential annexation policy from another community, and also make sure that the lands that we own on either side of 40 and control out in Richardson Flat are covered by our annexation policy. So this has to go through the Planning Commission by state law. The council gave direction. We needed a policy decision from the council which lands they wanted included in the policy, and it's not an annexation action. The there's a whole bunch of stuff they have to go through. This is just a policy action, just like the general plan. So the council directed us to have a look at the lands that we own in north end of Round Valley, Clark Ranch, which is east and west of US 40 and south of 248, the Richardson Flat lands that are controlled by the Flagstaff Development Agreement, and they took a fairly strong stance and said, we need to at least include Bonanza Flat in our annexation policy declaration. Whether or not we complete the annexation is completely a different argument that we're going to have, and Wasatch County needs to agree that we can annex it down the road, but it at least needs to get into the plan. So for the general public, this is a planning policy document. It's not an action. Planning Commission has to discuss it. There's three public hearings required by state law. We need to notify all the adjacent agencies. It gets pretty technical from there.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about that, though. I mean, is this what prompted it? Because when Hideout decided that it was going to expand its annexation area, that we kind of got wind of it. They didn't hold the public hearings or notify the agencies?
Hideout is Hideout, and we're still trying to get to the bottom of whether we were notified or not. But no, back in April, the council, and actually a year ago when Adam Strawn was the chair of the Planning Commission, we were discussing the annexation of Clark Ranch and the lands in Round Valley. We specifically excluded at that time Richardson Flat because we wanted to bring in Clark Ranch and the Round Valley lands without a lot of difficult conversations. At that time, the Planning Commission was concerned that we didn't have some land use decisions made on Clark Ranch and North Round Valley, and that we didn't have the conservation easements in place. So that never really moved forward. The council brought it forward again in April of 2019, said, what are you guys doing? Do we need to make some more policy decisions? So while Hideout and the other discussions around Jordanelle may have speeded this up, it was not the direct influencer of this action. The council's in charge.
Yeah. And let's talk a little bit about just how MIDA, this is the Military Installation Development Authority, which is has a project area. They also are expanding?
Yes, that's correct.
But it's not annexation.
No. It would be brought into their boundary. It would not be annexed in unless a community decided to annex them like Hideout. We don't have all the information about that right now. We've seen their policy map. It extends quite a ways up from the Jordanelle on the west side of 40 into some of the ski run areas of Deer Valley and approaches the Bonanza Flat property.
My understanding is that MIDA can only expand its project area with the property owner's consent. So is this property that's owned by Extel that they're talking about?
Extel, Mayflower, there's some other mine claims in there. There's some folks that own minor mine claims up there that are not, at this point, particularly interested in going in with the MIDA installation.
Yeah. But in terms of touching Bonanza Flat, I mean, that's how could that be expanded into MIDA?
Well, MIDA has a state legislative authority, and they can put out a policy plan that they want, and they can create the boundaries under the authority of the state legislature. They would not go into Bonanza Flat because all the underlying lands are owned by us. So they could come close depending on what the landowners up there wanted. At this point, we're just trying to get our arms around what MIDA's intentions are and how that affects the expansion of the skiing on the Jordanelle side and the development area. Wasatch County has a general plan and zoning out there, and it's controlled by the Jordanelle Special Planning Area. There's somewhere around 6,000 to 7,000 units around the lake that are currently planned by Wasatch County, of which roughly 2,000 units are on the west side of 40 and the west side of Jordanelle, plus some expansion of the skiing. And MIDA figures into that discussion. And then we're going to have to try and understand what the relationship is between MIDA, Wasatch County, and Hideout is as we go forward.
Well, the way I'm hearing it is that, MIDA, because of the tax increment financing that they have access to, they've got a project area. It was a draft plan back in 2012 that showed
a lot of this area that it could expand into. They don't even own any property at this point, though.
Well, that's correct. MIDA may or may not own the property. What they are is a sort of a state-legislated mandated land use authority. And so once MIDA comes in and does their thing according to the legislature, the land use authority rolls to MIDA. This is similar to the Falcon Ridge project up at Hill Air Force Base, and similar but not the same as the redevelopment of the prison site down by Draper, and may be similar to the Inland Port Authority that operates just west of Salt Lake City.
Yeah, but back to MIDA's plans. I mean, it's like the more property within their project area, the more tax dollars they would be able to collect, right?
Yes, but that would be tax increment. So that is the marginal difference between what would flow to the county and the changes in the value of the property as development occurs. So it's Wasatch County needs to, and they are, trust me, they are paying attention to this. The other communities that are potentially going to annex or manage some of these properties need to be paying attention to how the taxes go. Park City is certainly paying attention on our side of the hill, which is Richardson Flat, south of 248, the Clark Ranch, and how the council sees us moving forward with Bonanza Flat.
All right. That's some of the same property, though, that is in Hideout's proposed
absolutely,
annexation.
Absolutely.
So would he arm wrestle for it? I mean,
I know, if I understand correctly, more than one jurisdiction can put it in the annexation plan, and then the landowners can choose which jurisdiction they wish to participate in. However, we have significant land use controls on all of the Richardson Flatlands that came in with the Flagstaff annexation. And, you know, we need to throw some happy smiley faces out to my predecessors who negotiated with Summit County for our joint planning principles in the Quinns Junction, Richardson Flat area, all the way back to 2004, and then updated in 2014 in the county general plan and the city general plan for development rights in the Richardson Flat area, which is open space and minimum density.
So has Park City talked to the Hideout City Council about their plans?
Or? Yes, they have. The city manager and special counsel were at the Hideout City Council meeting about a month ago. They are reaching out to have conversations with the Hideout City Attorney and all four jurisdictions that are involved, which is Wasatch County, Summit County, us, and military installation development.
So what I've heard with regard to Hideout is that they're just looking for some commercial development to help offset. It's all residential development at this point. And as we know, residential development doesn't pay its way unless they're multi-million dollar second homes.
Well, even multi-million dollar second homes don't pay their own way. But and we're aware of that. I can't speculate on Hideout's motivations. What I can do is read their general plan. And the general plan considers annexation of certain other areas. Whether or not that makes fiscal sense, we're going to have to kind of think about. But I think we owe our citizens the obligation to make sure we're making fiscal sense in the Park City.
Okay. So what's going to happen then at Wednesday's meeting?
So our mission on Wednesday is to brief the Planning Commission on what the City Council asks us to do. Then we will outline the schedule. We'll bring the schedule back to the City Council on Thursday. We intend to have our policy plan put in place in approximately 3 months. And that assumes that we're not making any large-scale land use decisions. We're going to put everything in the policy plan in its current form and not change land uses until the council can give us additional direction and we can communicate with the public.
Okay. I noticed on work session, it was basically saying more information will be provided at the meeting with regard to the art and culture update. Can you brief us on that?
I can. Community Development Director Ann Laurent is managing the arts and culture district, and she's moving forward with the two potential main tenants, which are the Kimball and Sundance. We've committed to the City Council and to the Planning Commission to bring them up to speed early on these matters. So this is going to be an initial briefing on what the policies and procedures are for the Arts and Culture District. The Planning Commission is probably going to have to adjust the general plan to accommodate this use and reduce what we were talking about in 2014 for the Bonanza Park area. So we're looking at a general plan update at some point, and I do not expect additional zoning changes, but I think we're going to have to update the plan to accommodate what's going on. But we did commit to the council to make sure the Planning Commission was up to speed early and not just drive plans through the system.
Yeah, one of the reasons we were told we were buying this property was so that we could keep it to what it was zoned for. And when you're talking about changing the policies, are we talking about upzoning it? Or?
No. We're not at this point. My information from Ann is that we're going to meet the zoning codes. So I don't expect changing the land management code to accommodate this use. What I expect to do is the general plan contemplated redevelopment of the entire Prospector, Iron Horse, Bonanza Park District, just a complete redevelopment. Do it over again, go to mixed use, go to high density. That's not consistent with what the city is moving forward with now on arts and culture or on the housing on the Homestake lot. So we may need to think about how to make sure the general plan really reflects what's being brought forward. This is completely within the zoning ordinance as far as we know at this point.
Okay. So will we get some good information then Wednesday?
You'll see a PowerPoint from Ann. Mm-hmm. That's probably all we're going to do at this point because there's nothing fleshed out. There's nothing really firmed up. This is a continual negotiation with the two prime tenants and a negotiation on what we're going to do with Munchkin Road, Woodbine Road, and access over to Homestake.
And are we still talking some kind of transit center?
At this point, we are talking about a transit center. What that means and how many cars, I don't have that information at this point.
All right. Also on the regular agenda, another look at the Woodside Park Affordable Housing. This is phase one. We're going to do ratify a development agreement?
Right. This is, once again, this is pretty geeky and pretty wonky, but this has already moved through the entire approval process, but the Planning Commission is required to ratify the development agreement, saying, yes, this is what we agreed to. This is the findings of fact, conditions of approval that we did back a couple of months ago to remove the electric bike, the Summit County Bike Share Program, and increase the number of bike charging stations inside the project. So all they're going to do is ratify the agreement, and it's a paperwork deal, not a debate.
Okay. Do they have their COs yet, their certificates of occupancy?
I believe they're working on the final ones at this point. Planner Tyler is doing that.
Okay. Speaking of planners, you've lost not only Kirsten, but you've also Francisco left as well.
Oh, yeah. We had a little bit of a regime change over the last couple months. We're fully up to staff right now. I think you'd be impressed with the group of folks we've got, especially in terms of experience and diversity. We brought in a planner from Newton, Massachusetts, who has 15 years of experience, and she is a LEED certified, and she's a historic preservation person. So in her job previously, she managed 14 villages outside of Massachusetts, so she's exceptionally skilled at plats and subdivisions and zoning ordinances. We brought in a new historic preservation planner with a master's degree in architecture and a master's degree in historic preservation. We brought in a new operations manager, just trying to think what else I'm missing. But, yeah, I think you'd be impressed by the level of expertise we have at this point.
Yeah, but still, we've lost a ton of institutional knowledge with the exception of you. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm kind of the old dead guy in this thing. But I think in this particular case, the town has undergone another transition, and we needed some skill sets that can change the way our codes are written. Their mission at this point is to update the land management codes to get it to the correct section. I failed to mention our other senior planner, our land use policy planner who came on. She came over from our city attorney's office, and she has the lead on writing land management code stuff. Her main focus is updating the housing codes to make sure we're up to speed and being able to deliver affordable housing correctly.
Okay. So Francisco, though, didn't die of treasure abuse, huh?
He may have, but that's out of my jurisdiction. He went off to manage the city of Bountiful as planning director. Not real sure what dramas he's facing in Bountiful, but I'm sure there's something that'll keep him busy.
Okay, finally wanted just to ask, where are we with the Kimball Special Event Center?
Okay, so the Kimball, the authorization for use of the outside deck was an administrative conditional use permit. We conducted a public hearing. We took some public comments. We reviewed the conditions of approval. I have signed the authorization for the use of that deck. The 10-day appeal period is passed, and they have permission to use the deck in accordance with the administrative conditional use permit. We have not seen any additional information about what their uses are going to be. It's a fairly sophisticated document, but the key things for the public are that there will be a contact person posted on the building so that they know exactly who to comment to if there's an issue with noise or any other activity. And then second, Michelle Doward and the police department have been having ongoing meetings on continued enforcement of the noise ordinance, especially the new one. So police and us and executive have had ongoing meetings making sure we're doing the correct job of enforcing noise. So I think you'll see much cleaner enforcement of this, much more proactive enforcement of noise, and an easier system for the public to give input into the system.
So if we had some events up there?
None that I'm aware of at this point.
Yeah. So is there some kind of schedule, or is that private information?
I'm not party to that information, what they'll do on the deck. The deck cannot be operated separately from the indoor space. So there is no independent utility on that. And we've prohibited saying you can lease the deck to Bob and Madge for their wedding and lease the indoor for Kevin and Roger to have a wedding, right? They have to be done together, and they have to post the information, and they have to meet the noise ordinance, and there's some control mechanisms on amplified music.
Okay. And I know noise was concerned, but also traffic and drop-off and things like that. So
yeah, we have a control in there about the number of people and how many attendants they have to have during larger events. And it's on the order of 2 traffic control management folks for every 50 folks in the building.
Okay. Is that a valet? Is that what it...
No, it's more to keep people from attempting to poach the parking if there's a motor coach that comes up, and then it's attempting to make sure that people aren't trolling through the neighborhood looking for parking like they did on the 4th of July, if you will.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to mention?
Well, you did ask about the construction and Prospector on Lot G. That's a new project that's coming in. It's an interesting project in that it's 20 apartments. They're not deed restricted at this point, but they're smaller. And the difference is normally we have a really hard time doing just pure rental housing because it's difficult to finance and it's difficult to have a long-term return on investment. This particular investor knows how to do apartments, and so we're going to get 20 additional apartments on that lot with 20 or 21 parking spaces plus bike storage plus electric car charging in the underground space. So no net loss of parking once it's constructed in Prospector, and we'll have 20 apartments added to the housing stock.
So all the parking will be underground?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and that's that off a Sidewinder. It's kind of fenced in by blue fencing at this point.
Sidewinder or Prospector?
Is it Prospector?
Yeah, it's Prospector.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That's Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. Yesterday, the Park City Community Foundation announced the recipient of this year's $35,000 Women's Giving Fund High Impact Grant. In the studio, I have the director of the Community Foundation, Katie Wright, along with the director of this year's winner, Beth Armstrong, with People's Health Clinic. Good morning and congratulations, Beth.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, before we talk a little bit about how the money's spent, Katie, just give us a little bit of background here, how the foundation has raised the money to support these annual grants.
Absolutely. So the Park City Community Foundation's mission is to solve some of the community's most toughest problems, and the Women's Giving Fund is one of our more important programs. Back in 2013, we set the goal to raise $1,000 from 1,000 individuals to build a $1 million endowment that will permanently and forever support causes important to women and children throughout Summit County. And so this was our 5th grant from that endowment since that time. And it's been a really, really amazing thing to see the impact that the grants have had, not just the financial resources, which are critical, but also the volunteer time and expertise that the Women's Giving Fund members have lent to really important causes in Park City.
Okay, so these grants started, though, maybe just less than $30,000. Now we're up to $35,000 because we've got more money in the fund.
Yes, and so we manage the fund with an eye on forever, and that means that we want to make sure that the corpus is retained. We want to make sure that in lean times we can continue to support nonprofits at a high impact level, and that we plan for things like inflation.
Okay, so that's where we're going to kind of always end up, between $30,000, $35,000.
No, as the fund grows, the dollar amount will grow, and that is our intention. We're so excited that some Women's Giving Fund members, every member is a member for life. Some members choose to give annually as well to the fund, and we have new women and girls joining all the time. So over time, we hope that that endowment grows and that the grant also grows.
Okay, so you're not pulling all of the interest out. You are reinvesting some into
yes.
The... Mm-hmm. How many members now are we up to?
Are a little over 1,300 members, and that includes babies, which I love that a new girl is born in the community and people think, well, she better be a member, all the way up to some memberships made in memory or honor of a woman.
Yeah. And then the process for determining each year's winners are done by the members themselves.
Yes. So we have members who serve two-year committee memberships on the grants committee. And so they take the initial applications. We had 13 this year, which is around the average. And they sort through the applications. They look for, are these organizations well-governed? Is the grant high impact? They do site visits, and they narrow it down to three exceptional finalists. And really, we always have quality applications. And the final three are amazing. And I always tell people, you can really vote with your heart because you can't go wrong. Every project is deserving.
Okay. People's Health Clinic, again, was one of them. PC Tots, a second, and then Youth Sports Alliance.
Yes.
All asking for a little bit different things. Well, Beth Park, People's Health Clinic just celebrated its 20th anniversary. So you guys have been around a while. But tell us about some of the accomplishments then along the way then in those 20 years, because I think most people are familiar with who you are and what you do.
You would think that, but that we, on a weekly basis, I go out and meet with different organizations, with local restaurants, sit down and speak to employees in different companies, telling them who we are and what we do, and I always ask for a show of hands of who's heard of us and knows what we do. And it's shocking to me how few. So, and it's because we're a pretty transient community. So usually the people who need our services aren't here for long periods of time. They're coming in, they're working, and they stay a while, and then they leave, and new people come in and replace them. So we find ourselves constantly having to go out and talk about what we do and talk about our message. In the past 20 years, which is pretty shocking that it's passed that quickly, you know, Dr. Hanrahan just retired this year to go and be Rotary president, and I was concerned about what that change was going to do because he was just our champion and our, you know, one of the founders. And then we found that he's now supporting us in different ways. He goes out, he still goes in the community, talks about People's Health Clinic and what we do, and gets volunteers for us all the time. And he also comes back as a medical volunteer. So I basically still have him, but don't pay him, which is great. And over the past 20 years, we're now seeing, last year we had just under 10,000 patient encounters, which is remarkable for an organization our size. We only have a total of 11 bodies, only 8 of them are full-time, but we have 135 volunteers. Most of those are non-medical. We have about 37 medical volunteers. That's anything from PAs, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to medical doctors, orthopedic doctors. We've now partnered with both Dr. Hyden, and with RCM, Rosenberger Cooley Metcalf, to where they'll see one of our patients a month in surgery, so they do free surgeries for us. So these partnerships that we're doing help us leverage our monies. So we feel like we are great stewards of our donor dollars. On the on our budget last year for those almost 10,000 visits. It was with a budget of $846,000. This year's budget is almost the same. This is our 20th anniversary year, so we are throwing a big celebration. I refuse to call it a gala, which will be held September 6th at the Equestrian Center out at Promontory. So it's going to be a denim and diamonds type event with a bluebird style singer-songwriter series, three guys from Nashville. One of them is Chris Tomlin. He's a pretty well-known Grammy Award-winning artist, and he's a really good friend, and he's going to come and do that with two of his other friends. And Dr. Harrison, Mark Harrison, president of Intermountain, will be our keynote speaker. I always say, you know, a week after I asked him to be our speaker, he was named one of the 50 most influential men in the world. So I couldn't afford him a week later, but he had already said yes.
So this $35,000 is a grant specifically to benefit children and women. So of those 10,000 patient encounters, I mean, is it about two-thirds then that you're seeing women and children? Or
yeah,
even
about
more?
Yeah, so 6,000 women is about the round number. Whenever I first arrived at the clinic, we do a great job in seeing people's illness, solving people's problems and seeing them for their illnesses. But we were fixing problems, but we weren't preventing them. And I really, really wanted the 20th anniversary year to be about finding ways that we could educate our patients and keep them from having the issues that they were having, doing the dental prevention. And that, for us, dental prevention is, dental services are one of the biggest needs in that community. They don't, that's the last thing they do with their ancillary dollars. Sometimes it's between buying a meal or going to a dentist, they're going to buy the meal. So we really are looking at trying to increase our dental services. But when we see, for me, we just had a donor come to us and say, if I could find matching grant, he would give us money to buy a certain type of contraceptive device, which is called an Nexplanon, which is it's inserted in your arm, and it can last anywhere from 3 to 5 years, and it's tested through blood. We know how long it lasts. And he said that if I could match it, he would give me enough to supply most of what I need for the entire year in Nexplanons. And through this grant, I'm using this as my matching for that. And so we now have as many Nexplanon available for our community. So I encourage anyone that is interested in contraceptive care that does not have any form of insurance to come in and see us. And we can. We have Dahlia that will sit. She was with Planned Parenthood prior to coming to us, and she can sit down and explain to them. And she's also, you know, she's an ESL kid. She is a native Spanish speaker, which makes a big difference because she can speak to them where they are.
Okay. So let's see. We should make note that you had an anonymous grant.
Yes. For a couple years now, we've had a really amazing woman step up and make an anonymous grant of $10,000. And that means we're able to provide a $5,000 grant to each of the two runners-up. This year they were PC Tots, who is building an emergency fund for their families, so when a crisis happens, those families can weather the storm. And also Youth Sports Alliance, that has expanded its really amazing program, Get Out and Play and Activate, which is an after-school sports program for kids to try new sports out into the South Summit area. And that's also a really incredible program. So we're really pleased that those two excellent finalists also got some financial support. And we hope that they also get some new volunteers and things like that from the awareness built. And I should mention Big Brothers Big Sisters. They were our 2018 grantee, and it was wonderful to hear from Lacey Colray, who works there, about the impact that the grant last year had matching children with caring mentors. So the Women's Giving Fund has really achieved some impact for a community serving women and children, and I think we were only growing over the years.
Anything else you wanted to add, Beth?
Just how grateful we are, and so overwhelmed from the support that we receive from all the wonderful women in this group.
And if people want to learn more, they can visit parkcitycf.org, and you can learn about the finalists and becoming a Women's Giving Fund member.
All right, Katie Wright, Beth Armstrong, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.